In 2008, as the subprime mortgage crisis was unfolding, the nation's biggest banks were deemed too big to fail and their executives too big to jail. Nevertheless, some of those banks are settling with the federal government for billions of dollars while their executives are rewarded. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, sometimes called the King of Wall Street or America's least hated banker by the New York Times, received a raise of 74% not long after the firm settled for $13 billion and posted weaker than expected earnings. William D. Cohn has looked behind the curtain at the details of that settlement for his article, Jamie Dimon's $13 Billion Secret, the inside story of J.P. Morgan Chase's landmark mortgage settlement. It's in the current issue of The Nation. I'm very pleased that it brings William Cohn back to our show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard, how are you?
I'm well. The $13 billion, and I wish I was receiving the kind of salary that Jamie Dimon receives. The $13 billion settlement with the Justice Department was widely reported on last November. Is this something that we don't know about? It's something that was kept secret?
Well, I think that there was, which was the logic of the settlement, what got Jamie Dimon to settle. And that was something that I discovered as part of the reporting for this, which was that Ben Wagner, who was the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of California, had been investigating as part of a widespread Justice Department investigation into various parts of J.P. Morgan's businesses and other firms' businesses. He had been investigating what J.P. Morgan Chase itself, as opposed to Bear Stearns, which, of course, J.P. Morgan had acquired in March of 2008, or Washington Mutual, which it acquired later in 2008, had been doing in their businesses. So one thing Jamie Dimon had been saying publicly, and including to journalists like me, is that, well, the Justice Department was coming along and trying to penalize us for doing a favor for the federal government, which was buying Bear Stearns when it was troubled, buying Washington Mutual when it was troubled, and the thanks I get is this, you know, $13 billion settlement. But what Ben Wagner out in California had discovered was that J.P. Morgan Chase itself had been doing a lot of the same wrongdoing and underwriting the same kind of squirrely mortgage-backed securities that Bear Stearns had been doing and packaging up the same kind of mortgages that Washington Mutual had been packaging up. And this was something that Jamie Dimon didn't want people to know. Goes against the myth of that Jamie Dimon had created about how J.P. Morgan was the savior of the financial system at the request of the federal government during 2008. And so when push came to shove and Ben Wagner was about to file this civil lawsuit revealing all of this interesting information that he had dug up about J.P. Morgan, that's when J.P. Morgan Chase and Jamie Dimon decided to settle.
And Jamie Dimon, as I said, got a big raise. Is that for managing the settlement, for creating the myth that you were just talking about, or for something else?
Well, again, I'm not privy to what the board of directors at J.P. Morgan Chase decided when they gave Jamie Dimon his raise last year, but I think it's fair to assume that part of the reason he got it was because he, quote-unquote, got this settlement behind him, but really what he did was just use his shareholders' money to, you know, give the government the equivalent of $13 billion in cash and benefits, which was nothing out of his pocket or any of his management team's pocket or any of the executives or bankers or traders at J.P. Morgan Chase who did these deals in the first place. So, I mean, for him to get rewarded just by using his shareholders' money and he gets a raise up to $20 million seems the height of absurdity to me.
The complaint by Ben Wagner was never filed. How much of a say would Eric Holder have had on whether or not Wagner filed the complaint?
A complete say. And, you know, this goes back to what is I call sort of the Holder Doctrine. I don't know whether that's the official name or not, but basically in 2009 when he was Deputy Attorney General, Eric Holder authored this paper, this essay essentially, where he argued that, you know, among a lot of things he argued, but one of the things he argued was that, you know, in the long run it actually may not be such a great idea to, you know, indict a corporation because the collateral damage that results will be something that we don't really want. And I think that one of the examples that people ultimately turn to when they think about this is what happened to Arthur Andersen when it got indicted, and then the firm ended up going out of business and thousands of people lost jobs. And, you know, that I think Eric Holder thought that was too big a price to pay. So he sort of said, well, maybe we can penalize these people with huge fees and huge payments, and that will be almost like prosecuting them. Of course, it isn't anything like prosecuting them, because what happens is, as part of these settlements, I mean, you don't get J.P. Morgan Chase to cough up $13 billion, even if it's their shareholders' money, and you don't get Bank of America to cough up almost $17 billion, even if it's their own shareholders' money, if they're going to reveal all of these documents and emails about all the wrongdoing. So they end up covering up all of the emails and the documents that the American people have a right to see about what happened at these banks leading up to the crisis. But unfortunately, these settlements essentially cover all that up, and that is a huge problem, in my opinion, because we'll never get to find out what happened.
And in talking about the J.P. Morgan settlement, former Senate staffer and now lobbyist Jeff Connaughton said, I'm quoting, expectations had gotten so low for the Justice Department that I can't help but be a little pleased that they've done something. Yes, it's thin and weak, but it's also the first time in 5 years they haven't completely rolled over. Does the Obama administration have a record of caving to Wall Street pressure? And is that a carryover from what the way the Bush administration dealt with these things?
Well, I mean, you know, Wall Street loves to denigrate Obama and the Obama administration. But actually, if you think about it, Wall Street has almost never been treated better by a president. Obviously, George Bush and Henry Paulson bailed them out. But, you know, Obama, with Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, basically ratified those bailouts. And then, of course, the market has gone from 6,500 in March of 2009 to 17,100 today, a big day today in the market. Interest rates have been kept by Obama's Fed at extremely low levels, historically low levels, which, of course, benefits the top of the pyramid and benefits Wall Street by making it possible for them to get their raw material, which is money. They make money from money. They get their raw material for free. So basically, this has been the last, you know, 3 or 4 years have been a total bonanza for Wall Street, and they love to denigrate Obama. But I can't. If they had their own puppet president, he wouldn't have not done any better than what Obama has done for Wall Street. So it's totally ironic that they denigrate him for criticizing him when he's actually been incredibly supportive of Wall Street.
William D. Cohen's article, Jamie Dimon's $13 billion secret, the inside story of J.P. Morgan Chase's landmark mortgage settlement, is in the current issue of The Nation. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What role did state attorneys general like Eric Schneiderman have or play in pushing J.P. Morgan to settle?
Well, this is one of the more interesting aspects of this story, and I think one of the things that Attorney General Schneiderman wanted to be more widely known, which was the role that he played in keeping the government's focus on making these big banks cough up these huge fines for their pre-crisis underwriting of mortgage-backed securities. As I tell the story in the Nation article, Eric Schneiderman's focus on this sort of came when he first got into office a couple of Januaries ago, and it was in the midst of what was then called the National Mortgage Settlement, which many of us know is sort of the robo-signing settlement when banks were foreclosing on homes where they didn't have the paperwork on, and a group of five banks, one of which was J.P. Morgan Chase, paid around $5 billion each, a total of $25 billion to settle that piece of litigation. And Eric Schneiderman was concerned that out of that settlement, the banks would get released for their mortgage-backed security violations. So he made a big to-do publicly and in Washington to make sure that that wouldn't happen. Some of his other fellow state attorney generals, like Tom Miller, who's the state attorney general of Iowa, disputed that claim that Schneiderman had, that he ever would have allowed the banks to get released. But in any event, Schneiderman pushed very hard for this. He got himself appointed the co-head of the task force that was investigating the mortgage-backed security wrongdoing prior to the crisis. And Eric Schneiderman, I think, played a big role in making sure that these, as the New York State Attorney General, making sure these banks realized they were going to have to make a substantial settlement with the government to avoid litigation. And New York State, thanks in large part to Eric Schneiderman, ended up getting something like $600 million as part of the J.P. Morgan Chase $13 billion settlement.
Is there any indication of what specifically was in the complaint that J.P. Morgan wanted to keep out of the public eye? And is there any chance that we'll ever see it? Can a Freedom of Information Act request be made to force release of the complaint?
There is an indication of what was in it. There was something called the Statement of Facts, which is an extremely anodyne and sanitized version of, and heavily negotiated, I might add, that was about 20 pages long, that sort of described what J.P. Morgan Chase itself, as opposed to Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual, did wrong, and why ultimately the Justice Department was getting ready to file this Wagner complaint. And the only kind of interesting thing it alludes to is that there was this woman banker who had been working at J.P. Morgan Chase. She saw wrongdoing, that J.P. Morgan was packaging up mortgages that should never have been made in the first place and packaging them up into mortgage-backed securities. And she ended up, deciding that she couldn't really take it anymore. She left J.P. Morgan. But then the Justice Department managed to find her, because I guess there must have been emails that she had written. And then she basically told the Justice Department her story of what she had found. And so that kind of narrative is in this statement of facts, but it never mentions her name, of course, which, she deserves, frankly, to be singled out for her courage and bravery. It never mentions her name, and, it never really gets into the details of who was involved and what precisely they did wrong. But one gets enough of a sense that clearly J.P. Morgan Chase was not pure in their behavior leading up to this crisis. And as far as whether or not this complaint can ever come see the light of day, as I tell the story in the Nation piece at the end, we almost did see it. Clearly the Justice Department threatened to file it, and that got J.P. Morgan Chase to the settlement table, and then they threatened again to file it, and that got them to raise their price to $13 billion. But as part of this, a separate litigation was ongoing. The Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh had sued J.P. Morgan Chase for losses that it had suffered on a mortgage-backed securities that it had bought from J.P. Morgan. And as part of that lawsuit, they had demanded to see this complaint. And J.P. Morgan fought that request, but eventually the judge in that case ruled that that complaint had to be turned over to the Federal Home Loan Bank. And that at that moment, J.P. Morgan Chase got very concerned that they might make it public. And I was actually talking to some of their lawyers, and I got the sense that maybe I could even see it. And the next thing you know, they settled that complaint, and that they settled that lawsuit, and that complaint got sealed up once again. So it's out there, Leonard. Some enterprising reporter, I hope, will figure out a way to get it. Maybe it'll come in an empty manila envelope to me without any return address, and we'll be able to see it, because it would be really great for the American people to see what that complaint contained.
Last week, Bank of America agreed to pay over $16.5 billion to settle a federal investigation into the bank's sale of toxic mortgage securities. Now that's the largest settlement. Was that handled in the same way? Are there secrets there as well?
Yes, there are secrets there as well. There are secrets in the Citigroup settlement, which happened, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, for, $7 or $9 billion. I can't remember exactly what it was. So there have been these three big settlements. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, each contains secrets, each contain this anodyne statement of facts, each contains a lot of information and emails and documents that will never be made public because as part of the settlement they were all hushed up and covered up. And, the Justice Department is okay with that, and I'm frankly not so sure that is a good trade-off, but that's the decision that Eric Holder and his deputies made, and that seems to be the template now. And sort of next up is going to be Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and I'm sure they're going to insist that we never see the light of what they did wrong never sees the light of day either. I contrast this with Elliot Spitzer's, when he was Attorney General of the State of New York, his investigation into when research analysts and research writers on Wall Street essentially agreed to give favorable reviews of companies in exchange for banking business. You'll remember that whole situation from the early 2000s. And as part of the settlement that Eliot Spitzer reached with each of these banks, he released all sorts of interesting emails and documents, and we could actually see the names of the people who wrote these emails and what they wrote and what they were thinking about when they did this. It's an invaluable service. Senator Levin, Carl Levin, did the same thing in his investigation into what Goldman Sachs did leading up to the financial crisis, and also what J.P. Morgan Chase did in the London Whale fiasco of a couple years ago. But for whatever reason, the Justice Department has reached this settlement with these banks and agreed not to make this stuff public.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll find out why these settlements don't hurt these banks as much as they would appear to. My guest is William D. Cohen. His article, Jamie Dimon's $13 billion secret, the inside story of J.P. Morgan Chase's landmark mortgage settlement. It is in the current issue of The Nation. Stay with us for more. We are back with William D. Cohen. His article, Jamie Dimon's $13 billion secret, the inside story of J.P. Morgan Chase's landmark mortgage settlement, is in the current issue of The Nation. And on the day that the J.P. Morgan Chase deal was announced, that it would pay $13 billion to the bank's financial officer said that $7 billion was tax deductible. That's more than half of it. Does that mean that taxpayers will effectively end up paying a large part of what's supposed to be a penalty for the bank?
Yes, there is a portion of each of these settlements that, for whatever reason, the IRS has decided is tax deductible. And so, in effect, I guess, even though, you know, taxpayers, I guess, are getting a windfall in the billions of dollars, because the money goes into, you know, the Treasury in effect, and other mortgage customers of these banks are getting relief, a to-be-determined amount of relief on their mortgages or and other soft benefits. Yes, in fact, we as taxpayers are helping pay for these settlements by allowing some aspect of them to be tax deductible.
As a business expense.
Yes.
A penalty as a business expense. $13 billion is supposed to aid distressed homeowners. How will the federal government monitor that aid? Do we know?
Well, they actually do have a monitoring element, just like they do in the national mortgage settlement, which was sort of $25 billion, as I've said, of sort of benefit to consumers and homeowners, and they are monitoring it, and there are occasionally, I think, quarterly reports about how the banks are doing. And by the way, not all of the banks are doing what they're supposed to be doing, so it's a good thing that it's being monitored. But I think basically these banks are above shame at this point. They make these big payments. They use their shareholders' money to do it. The board of directors, as we were talking before, rewards their CEOs with raises. I mean, you know, it's really not supposed to work this way, Leonard. I think we could all agree that a much more effective deterrent would be if they actually went after the individuals who did the wrongdoing. If that included the CEOs of these banks, they should be charged civilly, and they should have to pay penalties out of their own pocket instead of, and Lord knows they have the money to do it, instead of using their shareholders' money. I mean, basically, there's no deterrent. I mean, I hate to be like a parent talking about a child, but if you don't punish anybody for their wrongdoing and you just sort of make it slide and, in fact, reward them for, quote unquote, getting it behind them, then they're going to repeat the behavior. And it's inevitable that that's going to happen. And it's not right. The American people deserve more. We demand more.
The shareholders don't seem to be all that upset. Bank of America's stock shares went up 4% following the announcement of their settlement. So Wall Street seems to think it was a good thing for Bank of America.
Well, and they thought it was a good thing for J.P. Morgan Chase as well. I mean, I think last year J.P. Morgan Chase's stock was up 25% or so. The truth is, Leonard, that shareholders are, of course, forward-looking. They want to know how much money the bank can earn, you know, next year and the year after. And one of the things that holds back these institutions is this sort of overhang of litigation. So to make that litigation go away, even if it seems like to you and I, which is a very big number, $13 billion or $16 to $17 billion, those seem like big numbers to us, but they are seriously big numbers, but they're using their shareholders' money to do it. They're, quote-unquote, getting the litigation behind them. The litigation overhang is removed, and that gives investors a clearer view of what kind of earnings these banks can make, and that's what they really care about. So when this litigation overhang goes away, the stock prices tend to go up.
Does the fact that so many banks have been implicated in sales of toxic assets help to insulate individuals like Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, and others from prosecution? Can they take a kind of everybody-was-doing-it defense?
Well, I think that they probably do that, yes. I think that is the argument that they make with the Justice Department. But, you know, okay, so everybody was doing it. I mean, last time I checked, that's not the greatest excuse that you can come up with. And frankly, part of the reason that Jamie Dimon probably didn't want Ben Wagner to file his lawsuit is because in that lawsuit were the names and the emails and the documents, and it would have been very easy for additional litigation to be brought, more of a roadmap by people who had bought the mortgage-backed securities and lost money. They could have more easily brought a lawsuit and pinpointed who to hold responsible. But, you know, the banks do not want the individual bankers and traders and executives to be held responsible, which is fine. I understand that from their perspective. That makes total sense. But why Eric Holder and the Justice Department lets them get away with that is something that I really have trouble understanding. And, you know, they deserve credit, as Jeff Conaton said, for actually doing something. But, you know, extracting, some would say it's extortion, but extracting these huge payments out of bank shareholders is not the same thing as holding the individuals who did these things wrong responsible. And that's what still has not happened.
Are state agencies bound by settlements the federal government makes? Could a state attorney general like Eric Schneiderman do what the Obama administration won't, the sort of thing that Elliot Spitzer used to do?
Well, you know, Eric Schneiderman, again, to his credit, did do that. He brought a separate lawsuit against Bear Stearns. He brought a separate lawsuit against Credit Suisse for the wrongdoing that they did in the mortgage departments leading up to the crisis. But all those two suits, the Bear Stearns suit, because now it's owned by J.P. Morgan Chase, was settled as part of the overall settlement. And I'm pretty sure that Eric Schneiderman would be barred at this point from bringing an additional lawsuit against J.P. Morgan Chase for these, mortgage-backed security violations. I think, you know, this is what, quote-unquote, a global settlement is all about. This is what the $13 billion is all about, to stop additional litigation and, of course, to keep people's names out of the public eye.
Have any of the big banks ever threatened to move their operations out of New York State if it pursues prosecutions against them?
I have not heard of that. I mean, there was a time, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, 9 years ago, when London seemed to be becoming more and more a center of world finance, and that banks were talking about moving more of their operations over there.
Burger King.
And now Burger King and other big medical drug companies are moving. Of course, Burger King is talking about doing a deal with a Canadian company, but drug companies have, moved their quote-unquote headquarters to London and merged with British companies to the so-called inversions to reduce their tax base. What Wall Street talks about doing now is sort of because of the Volcker Rule, which prevents them from doing proprietary trading, is sort of moving the trading of derivatives and other more opaque securities that are hard to value and they're very profitable for these banks to London, where the regulations are different. So they're sort of venue shopping, and they're constantly venue shopping. But, New York has again become the sort of locus of power in world finance, because European banks have really sort of fallen off the map as a result of the financial crisis. And so I don't hear anybody talking so much about moving their operations to London. But now, you know, nothing would surprise me that maybe one of these big Wall Street banks will do an inversion deal and merge with some UK bank to take advantage of the lower tax rates.
Is there any evidence that JP Morgan Chase actually broke the law, or are the laws regulating banks too lax?
I mean, is it against? I would think. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, Leonard, but I would think it's against the law to knowingly package up mortgages that you know are going to default and sell them off as investments all around the world. I just can't imagine that is legal. And I think that there are emails and documents that show knowledge, knowingly doing this and yet doing it anyway. You get sort of hints of that in these so-called statement of facts. So to me, that sounds like illegal behavior, whether it's criminal, whether it's civil illegality. You know, I'm not smart enough to know. I'm not a lawyer, but it isn't right. It should be prosecuted. They should be held accountable. And the problem with these settlements is they let these people off the hook. And that is not good for the American people. And by the way, we're reaching the statute of limitations on some of this stuff now. You know, this all happened, 6 years ago. And for it not to, for there not to be prosecution is a major wasted opportunity. After the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s, there were all sorts of bankers prosecuted. In fact, the Financial Times reported that something like 3,500 bankers were prosecuted, and most of whom went to jail for wrongdoing. This time, there's been nobody. Nobody.
But haven't some prosecutors argued that these cases are so complicated that the government just doesn't have the resources to pursue them? And when they do pursue them, often juries don't get it and they wind up losing the case.
I don't buy the no resources argument. I mean, the government has infinite resources. They could take some of the settlement money they just got and put more men on the job and more women to prosecute these cases. And I believe these emails and documents show a beautiful roadmap of what went wrong. I mean, you can see that in the information that Carl Levin has made public. You can see that in the emails and the documents that I dug up as part of my book on Bear Stearns, which showed wrongdoing at Bear Stearns. But to your point, precisely, you know, when the government in the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn brought the case against the two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, a criminal case, for essentially making those two hedge funds go defunct and having investors lose something like $1.5 billion, that case went before a jury, and the jury acquitted them. And so it's made the government apparently very gun-shy. I don't know why it would make them gun-shy. I mean, they should, if they've got the evidence, they should prosecute these cases. Instead, it makes them gun-shy, and I don't understand it. They expect to win all of their cases. Therefore, if they lose one, they stop trying to prosecute it. I think there's been plenty of evidence that could be a case could be brought against individuals, but that's not the Holder doctrine.
Just this past May, Holder said there's no such thing as too big to jail, although he was one of the people who proposed the idea that some financial firms are too influential to prosecute for criminal conduct. Or am I a bit confused about that?
No, I think you're right. And, you know, remember the famous Frontline episode, I guess it was earlier this year or last year, where Lanny Brewer, who was the number two to a Holder in the Justice Department, on film, on camera, said that he, you know, loses sleep at night because he worries that maybe prosecuting these too big to fail banks, you know, would have collateral damage that he's not willing and comfortable living with, i.e. the very giving voice to exactly what Eric Holder had written in 1999. And it clearly is the MO of this Justice Department. There's no question about that. I mean, and yet I find it ironic that the bankers, Wall Street bankers, complain about the Obama administration and the Obama Justice Department. Again, they've gotten a break here. Can you imagine if Elliot Spitzer was running the Justice Department? I mean, he would be going after these guys tooth and nail. Instead, they're getting off relatively easy by using their shareholders' money to make these big settlements.
It's been suggested that he paid a price for doing that. And that's why he's no longer the governor. Hasn't Hillary Clinton been indicating that she'll take a lighter approach than Obama?
Well, I'm sure she will, because, I mean, if she gets elected, because, Obama, of course, got a lot of support from Wall Street, financial support from Wall Street in 2008. But in 2012, they all, of course, supported one of their own, which was Mitt Romney. Hillary Clinton is very, very tight with Wall Street. The Clintons have always been very tight with Wall Street, and I'm sure that I'm sure there will be new things to investigate and prosecute when it comes to Wall Street, because there always seems to be. I'm sure that she will have an even lighter touch than Eric Holder, if that's possible.
Now, New York Magazine editor Duff McDonald described Jamie Dimon as a Wall Street hero in his book, 2009, The Last Man Standing. He said Dimon was, quote, moral and managerial compass for both his industry and the country itself. Is Jamie Dimon still seen that way in those circles?
I think Duff's book was lionized Jamie a little bit. I wrote a Vanity Fair profile of Jamie Dimon with Bethany McLean a couple years ago, and I think we showed a more complex picture. He's obviously human like the rest of us. He has been very outspoken generally on Wall Street, more outspoken than probably any other senior executive, which has, of course, occasionally got himself into trouble, like describing the London Whale fiasco, where J.P. Morgan lost $6 billion on a trade, on a series of trades, as a tempest in a teacup. That probably was not wise. He's called out journalists who asked him questions at various public hearings and sort of made fun of them for not making as much money as he does. So he has put his foot in his mouth a couple of times. He's whip smart. He's, really gotten that bank, which was a very balkanized institution after a series of many mergers. He really whipped the bank into shape. He created what he called this fortress balance sheet that got it through the financial crisis. Obviously, everybody knows J.P. Morgan Chase was the go-to bank to buy Bear Stearns and buy Washington Mutual and even others. I mean, Hank Paulson wanted Jamie Dimon to buy Morgan Stanley and reunite Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan, but he said no. I mean, he certainly likes to portray himself as being, as you said in the intro, the king of Wall Street and the smartest guy in the room. I think, of course, the truth is, like with anybody, is more nuanced. And, he breaks a lot of glass, which is, you don't get to the top of these institutions by being a nice guy all the time.
Well, these executives, we have no time, but executives claim credit for good performance but innocence when there's wrongdoing. And it looks like GM executives may emerge unscathed from the scandal over recalls. Maybe Preet Bharara will go after some of these people as well, although it's unlikely. But my great thanks to you, William D. Cohen, for being a guest on our show again. Jamie Dimon's $13 billion secret, the inside story of J.P. Morgan Chase's landmark mortgage settlement, is in the current issue of The Nation.